everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on living with the bomb right after this. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton. Now, these remarks by Swinton were made then by the preeminent New York journalist one night in 1880. Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft, and someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press in America. Swinton totally outraged his colleagues when he said, "There is no such thing at this date of world's history, especially in America, as an independent press, and you know it and I know it. And there's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write an honest opinion would be out on the streets looking for another job. Now, if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of journalists is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. You know that, and I know it. And what folly is this toasting of an independent press?" Swinton said, "We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings, and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes." Now, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program and this New World Order, men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers, Bushes, Bundys, Carnegies, and Vanderbilts. That's why I contend that it's time for us to wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and survive this New World Order and Global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about Global 2000 and Bible prophecy, this New World Order, why don't you call and order my 4-hour compact disc package. Remember, it's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, best of all, it's free of charge. You can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send your email request. Do it right now before you forget. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, August the 6th, 1945, was a momentous date in history. We didn't call it 8-6 like we call it 9-11 or 7-7, but August 6, 1945 marked the bombing of Hiroshima. 3 days later, they bombed Nagasaki. Well, 2005 marks the 60th anniversary, and we've been living with the bomb now for 60 years. I often think about 60 years ago, 1945, I was a little kid, having lived through World War II, born at the end of the Depression. I can remember my family talking about this atomic bomb as a little kid. They thought that it meant the end of the world. It probably does, but it didn't then. 60 years have elapsed. We've been waiting for the second coming of Christ for 2,000 years, and it hasn't happened yet. But every day that goes by makes it one day closer. And every day that goes by makes this inevitability of this nuclear war one day closer. Living with the bomb. You know, 60 years ago, on a stormy night in 1945, the charismatic American physicist Robert Oppenheimer mounted the stage of a movie theater in the secret city of Los Alamos, New Mexico. Oppenheimer, lean and intense, he was there to address hundreds of scientists, the men and women who had built the first atomic bombs under his direction. Exploded over the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August the 6th and August 9th, 1945, these bombs had just ended the most destructive war in all of human history. And they changed the face of war and international geopolitics forever. The world would soon learn what they already knew, Oppenheimer warned, and that is that nuclear weapons were surprisingly cheap and easy to make. Well, at least once you understood how. Soon, he said, other countries would be making these nuclear weapons also.
Their power of destruction, he said, already incomparably greater than that of any other weapon, will grow, he declared. And despite these unsettling predictions, Oppenheimer found positive benefit in the breakthrough, calling nuclear weapons not only a great peril, but a great hope, unquote. Well, what was Robert Oppenheimer thinking? The peril was obvious. Hiroshima and Nagasaki lay in ruins, with tens of thousands killed and thousands more seriously injured. What great hope do these nuclear weapons offer? 60 years later, we are still wondering and asking that question. What great hope lie in nuclear weapons? Well, today, 8 countries brandish their own nuclear arsenals, and approximately 20 other nations possess the technology and materials to go nuclear in about 1 year, if they ever decide to do so. And nations are only one part of this nuclear story. The breakup of the Soviet Union put a vast array of nuclear weapons and nuclear materials at risk of theft or clandestine sale to non-state actors, either terrorist groups or criminal networks. Expertise, too, is in demand worldwide. Now, the so-called father of the Pakistani atomic bomb, his name is Abdul Qadir Khan, is reported to have passed nuclear secrets and nuclear weapons production technology and atomic bomb designs to Libya, North Korea, and Iran. And some people fear now that his network may have passed these secrets on to others as well. Now, since the mid-1990s, Osama bin Laden and his followers have dreamed of acquiring nuclear devices to use in devastating attacks on the United States. Now, no one knows whether terrorists are closing in on a radiological dirty bomb or even a nuclear weapon. But living with the bomb continues along with a number of companion features in the August 2005 issue of the National Geographic magazine. Now, a shockwave has come down to the countdown to Hiroshima. Now, those who revere John Hershey's Hiroshima as a classic piece of reporting about an act unprecedented in human history, the instantaneous annihilation of tens of thousands of civilians by human agency, may approach a new book on the subject with lowered expectations. The name of the book, Shockwave, Countdown to Hiroshima, published by HarperCollins for $26.95. Stephen Walker has painted on a larger canvas, beginning this tale of both ghastly destruction and a gamble to end a protracted war by visiting the site in the New Mexico desert where the atomic bomb was first tested. From then on, he switches back and forth from the United States to the doomed Japanese city, from the Imperial Palace in Tokyo to the so-called Little White House near Potsdam, Germany, where President Harry Truman got a briefing on the new weapons progress in late July of 1945 while attending the Potsdam Conference in Germany. In Hiroshima, Walker zeroes in on the experience of a soldier named Toshaki Tanaka. Tanaka was separated from his wife and child by his military duties when the bomb fell. Tanaka went searching for his wife and infant child for them the next day, but he knew that there was no hope once he found a neighbor who he could recognize only by a telltale belt buckle that he had worn. Then Tanaka saw two figures like charcoal sticks fused together on the ground, facing what was once the doorway to his family-owned liquor store. One of the figures was much smaller than the other, a tiny, shapeless bundle pressed against the other's back as if somehow clinging to it, and he knew immediately that his wife and baby daughter were dead. He stood perfectly still, staring at them. Despite the terrible burns, their bones stood out. They were extraordinarily white, and he could not understand how it was possible that they were so white. He bent down beside them, then he picked up the bones, placing them one by one in his handkerchief. He walked out into the street that no longer existed, and he took the bones of his wife and infant child all the way back to his barracks in Eugene. There, he placed them, still in their handkerchief, on a shelf above his bed in his barracks quarters. It was the only home that he had left. Now, Hiroshima's bomb may have carried a hidden agenda. The U.S. decision to drop atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945 was meant to kickstart the Cold War rather than to end the Second World War, according to two nuclear historians who say that they have new evidence backing this controversial theory. Causing a fission reaction in several kilograms of uranium and plutonium and killing over 200,000 people 60 years ago was done more to impress the Soviet Union than it was to cow Japan, they say, and the U.S. president who took the decision, Harry Truman, was culpable, they also add. Truman knew that he was beginning the process of annihilation of the species, says Peter Kuznick. He's the director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at the American University in Washington, D.C. It was not just a war crime, it was a crime against humanity, the two writers insist. According to the official U.S. version of history, an atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, and another on Nagasaki 3 days later to force Japan to surrender. The destruction was necessary to bring a rapid end to the war without the need for a costly U.S. invasion. But this is disputed by Kuznick and Selden. A historian from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, they are presenting their evidence at a meeting in London on Thursday organized by Greenpeace and others to coincide with the 60th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Japan. New studies of U.S., Japanese, and Soviet diplomatic archives suggest that Truman's main motive was to limit expansion of the Soviet Union in Asia. Japan surrendered because the Soviet Union began an invasion a few days after the Hiroshima bombing, not because of the atomic bombs themselves, he says. Now, according to an account by Walter Brown, an assistant to then U.S. Secretary of State James Burns, Truman agreed at a meeting 3 days before the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima that Japan was looking for peace. Truman was told by his army generals, Douglas MacArthur and Dwight Eisenhower, and his chief of staff, the chief of naval operations, William Leahy, that there was no military need at this stage in the war to use the bomb. Impressing Russia was more important than ending the war in Japan, says Selden. Truman was also worried that he would be accused of wasting money on the Manhattan Project to build the first nuclear weapons if the bomb was not used. Kuznick and Selden's arguments, however, are generally dismissed as discredited. A war expert from the King's College in London, Lawrence Friedman, says that Truman's decision to bomb Hiroshima was understandable under the circumstances. Truman's main aim had been to end the war with Japan, Friedman says, but adds that, with the wisdom of hindsight, the bombings of Japan may not have been militarily justified. Some people assume that the United States always had a malicious and nasty motive, he says, but there isn't any proof that that's necessarily so. I'm reading from the Calamity Howler. Now, the Calamity Howler is published by A.V. Krebs. You can subscribe to the Calamity Howler and the Agriculture Examiner by simply sending your email address to avkrebs@earthlink.net. That's avkrebs@earthlink.net. To receive it, you simply send your name and address. That'd be your name and your email address. It comes over the computer. It's called the Calamity Howler. It's a leftist view of politics, but oftentimes the leftists do have some interesting and some very poignant comments to make. I especially like the Agricultural Examiner and Calamity Howler. Krebs searches the various and sundry news media and pulls out some good articles, of which I thought I'd share a couple of them with you here, because it is August the 6th, 2005. This is the big anniversary of the beginning of the nuclear age. Remember, that's avkrebs@earthlink.net. So if there's anyone to remember, it's avkrebs, that's A-V-K-R-E-B-S, all one word, at earthlink.net. He finances these newsletters over the web by voluntary contributions. I would suggest $25 a month or about $300 a year. This is a 21-page report, and it comes out four times a month. And the Examiner comes out also once a week. That's four times a month. Now, I don't know if he publishes 52, but that would be about 100 issues of both of these news reports. For $300 would be about 33 cents per issue. So I would say that's a heck of a value. And if you don't send him anything, he'll still send it to you. You're on the mailing list, but he has to have a methodology whereby he can sustain himself and to pay for the research and to pay for the publication of the material. So it's my suggestion, not his, that you send about $25 a month. I think that's a reasonable price for this newsletter, which you can subscribe for essentially free of charge. Remember, that's avkrebs@earthlink.net. Just send your email address and ask to be put on the mailing list. Here's another article here, God, Bush, and the Bomb, by Paul Cantor. I'm going to leave it out. It's a leftist view, a view that I don't subscribe to. And when I don't subscribe to a particular view, then I don't air it and I don't view it. But other articles in here, here's an article by Why Feel Guilty About Hiroshima, by Max Boot of the Los Angeles Times, another left-leaning viewpoint, but I think a point well taken. Listen to this. He says, the 60th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, has not so far provoked the kind of anguished debate that accompanied the 50th anniversary. The lack of controversy is fitting because there wasn't much soul-searching at the time. In 1945, 85% of Americans approved of a step deemed necessary to end the war and to head off a costly invasion of Japan. Only with the Axis threat long vanished and vanquished, have numerous historians and philosophers come forward to claim that the use of the A-bomb was unnecessary and that it was an atrocity that blemishes American honor. These criticisms rest, it seems to me, on a profoundly ahistorical assumption, and that is that there was something unusual about what happened to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It is true that the atomic bombs were, by many orders of magnitude, the most powerful explosives ever employed, but the havoc that they caused, with a combined death toll of over 100,000, was far and away anything that we could call unprecedented. You see, by the time the Enola Gay took off, at least 600,000 Germans and 200,000 Japanese had already been killed in Allied air raids during World War II. Conventional explosives had reduced all of the major cities of both Japan and Germany to rubble, and in the end, no more than one-third of the total Japanese deaths from air raids and just over 3% of the total land area destroyed could be attributed to the nuclear attacks. Far from being unusual, then, these two atomic bombs merely marked the culmination of an already well-established principle that urban areas, cities, were fair game for aerial attack. The first air raid that occurred in history was on August the 30th, 1914. That was just 11 years after the Wright brothers' first flight, when a flimsy German monoplane dropped five small bombs on Paris, France. August 30th, 1914. Five small bombs. Britain and France quickly retaliated with their own air raids on German soil. Though losses from aerial bombardment were minuscule during World War I, the Germans suffered about 1,900 people killed or wounded. Vast improvements in aircraft after 1918 ushered in the age of annihilation. Now, the Western democracies protested in 1937 when the German Condor Legion pounded Guernica, and Japanese aircraft did the same to Shanghai, but it did not take long for them to emulate the enemy's example. Starting in 1940, the Royal Air Force unleashed bomber raids against German cities to be joined in 1942 by American B-17s and B-24s. Long-range B-29s, whose development cost more than the Manhattan Project, allowed Japan to be added to the target list in 1944. To avoid the implication that they were guilty of terror bombing, Allied leaders claimed that they were simply dehousing German workers or eliminating cottage industries that supported the Japanese war effort. But they knew perfectly well that bombing was so inaccurate that hitting anything, even a major war plant, required saturating a large area with bombs, including plenty of civilians, with high explosives or incendiaries. But oh, how times have changed. Today, we can put smart bombs through the window of an office building. Along with greater accuracy has also come a growing impatience with collateral damage. A bomb that goes astray and hits a foreign embassy or a wedding party now causes international outrage, whereas 60 years ago, the destruction of an entire city like Dresden or Berlin or Tokyo was a frequent occurrence. Now, does this make us more enlightened than the greatest generation of World War II? Well, we certainly have the luxury today of being more discriminating in the application of violence. But even today, there is cause to doubt whether more precision is always better. During the initial invasion of Iraq in 2003, the United States was so sparing in its use of force that many Ba'athists never understood that they had been beaten in the war. The butcher's bill that we dodged early on is now being paid with compound interest. It's hard to imagine how many more GIs and Tommies would have perished in 1944 and 45 had the Anglo-American leaders flinched from using all of the means at their disposal to hasten the end of the war. Indeed, if the United States had staged a blood-drenched invasion of Japan while holding back its atomic arsenal, it is certain that President Truman would have been indicted for that decision also. Now, I can't claim to have worked out the moral calculus of bombing. I remain troubled by the deliberate killing of civilians, however, whether by the United States or by United States enemies. But I don't think the atomic bombing of Japan was a unique or a reprehensible event. There's plenty of blame to go around for the horrors of World War II, and most of it belongs to the original axis of evil. In short, I refuse to participate in the self-indulgent second-guessing that has become a growth industry in the history profession. Now, Max Boot is Olin's senior fellow in the National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. He's also a contributing editor to the Weekly Standard and a weekly columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Here's another article here on Hiroshima, the birth of nuclear warfare, by James Stimgold, San Francisco Chronicle. He says the atomic bombing of Hiroshima on August 6, 1945 was to change the course of history, but as Harold Agnew, Harold Agnew witnessed the flash that is estimated to have killed more than 100,000 people. He thought of just one thing. That is destroying the enemy. Agnew was then a frightened 24-year-old physicist flying in a plane alongside the Enola Gay bomber. He was in charge of measuring the yield of a blast that burned hotter than the sun. He had helped design the atomic bomb at Los Alamos, New Mexico, but for all of the impact this unique new weapon would have on science, military planning, and geopolitical rivalries, Agnew, who is now 84 years old, said that he and his colleagues saw the bomb in simpler terms. It was an instrument of their anger at Japan for launching this war in the first place and as a way of stopping the war in the second. We all wanted to crush the Japanese. Agnew, who became director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory in the 1970s, said in an interview, quote, "My only concern was winning the war. To say that we were embittered would have been a gross understatement." Within a few years, the full import of the 9,600-pound little boy warhead dropped on Hiroshima became clear. The technology spread, the arms race, and the Cold War with the Soviet Union revved up, and immensely more powerful thermonuclear warheads have been developed. An abstract and dangerous poker game was played by the superpowers in which the stakes were apocalyptic, but catastrophe seemed to grow increasingly remote because the feared war strategies involving the launching of thousands of missiles never took place. Now, a new lower-profile arms race has started that experts say is far less abstract and could prove to be far more dangerous. 6 decades have passed since the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and 16 years have now elapsed since the collapse of the Soviet Union. But nuclear technology is proliferating among second-tier powers, and it's a possibility among terrorist groups today. So the legacy of Hiroshima, when the weapons were built not just to deter, but to be actually used, has excruciatingly new and painful relevance today. Hang on a second. We'll be back with more on living with the bomb when we come back right after this message. You're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. The Law Hour website is updated weekly and it has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Remember, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, simply call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications used on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this local radio station. So for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're back and we are reviewing The Calamity Howler. The Calamity Howler is put out by A.V. Krebs. Now, Krebs, you know, most of the listeners here to the Law Hour and Editorial Review are radical right-wing reactionary conservatives, and The Calamity Howler is a radical left-wing publication. Now, I, from time to time, review all kinds of publications, such as I read Mein Kampf one time, but I deny that I'm a Nazi, and I, from time to time, read over the air the 10 Planks to the Communist Manifesto, and I've commented on them numerous times. So I don't want to be confused by any new listeners out there with being a leftist, but from time to time, you know, even the Pope comes up with a novel, new, and revolutionary idea that I agree with. And from time to time, even the leftists, you know, from the Ted Kennedys and so on, oftentimes point their finger at the abuses that go on in the right-wing extremist category. So in order to keep our balance from time to time, I like to review A.V. Krebs. Now, Krebs is a pretty good old boy. I like his selection of articles. I don't always agree with him, but oftentimes I do. Oftentimes, the left have some very, very good and salient points, and we ought to pay attention to them. Not always, not often, and I don't subscribe to the left view very often, but again, from time to time, there are some salient points. And this week's edition of the Calamity Howler, I thought was extraordinary, especially as it relates to this thing of living with the bomb. A number of articles have been published from a number of sources. For instance, this one, Living with the Bomb, is in the National Geographic, August 2005, written by Richard Rhodes. And Countdown to Hiroshima, Dennis Drabel, Washington Post, July 31st, 2005. And Hiroshima Bomb may have been carrying a hidden agenda, Rob Edwards of The New Scientist, July 21st, 2005. And this article that I'm reviewing here, Max Boot, The Los Angeles Times, August 3rd, 2005, Why Feel Guilty About Hiroshima. And then James Stemgold, The San Francisco Chronicle, August 1st, 2005, is the article that we're reviewing right now. He goes on to say that it's almost as though history has come full circle. The concern now is not Cold War brinksmanship, but the prospect, once again, that a single weapon detonated in anger could instantly send history in a violent new direction. Today, a single nuclear detonation in Detroit or New York City would dramatically change our society in every respect. Our politics, our civil liberties, our relations with other states and nations, said Steve Andreessen. He's a nuclear weapons expert in the Reagan and the first Bush and the Clinton administration. Now, during the Cold War, the idea, he said, of a single explosion was not seen as a credible issue. Now, however, we're back again to the notion of small-scale use of a nuclear weapon, a suitcase bomb, or a smuggled nuclear weapon brought into America in a shipping container. And the reality is that the effect would be as great as it was 60 years ago when the first nuclear weapon was dropped on Hiroshima. The likelihood of a single attack in a single city is greater than ever. Not the massive attacks that we imagined in the heart of the Cold War, said Graham Allison. He's the director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a senior Defense Department official in the Clinton administration. Eugene Hebiger, he's a retired Air Force general, who during the 1990s led the United States Strategic Command, the military arm that prepares for and would manage a nuclear war. He said that a bomb would not even have to be used accurately, just indiscriminately exploded in any city. It would have a horrific impact by any measure, said Hebiger. He's now a member of the board of the Nuclear Theater Initiative. That's the Nuclear Theater Initiative, an international non-governmental group that is working to reduce nuclear stockpiles. You might only kill 5,000 people or so with a small nuclear suitcase bomb, but you would change the society, change the politics, and change the economics of the United States forever. That's what I call the greatest threat of the 21st century. It's no longer about large military forces fighting head-to-head, Hebiger added. It's what I call asymmetric warfare. Now, one of the few things that President Bush and Senator John Kerry agreed on in the 2004 presidential campaign was that nuclear terrorism was the single greatest threat that the United States faces today. Now, the president was and has placed halting the North Korean and Iranian nuclear programs at the top of his policy agenda, and he has refused to rule out any military strikes or war to stop them. Now, many experts say that the problem goes well beyond those two countries, North Korea and Iran, and some worry that Bush's nuclear policies are increasing the threat rather than decreasing the threat of nuclear war. Now, the president has indicated that he wants to replace the current aging stockpile of nuclear weapons in the United States with a new generation of more flexible warheads, which some experts say could make possession of the weapons appear even more essential and even encourage more countries to ramp up their own nuclear efforts. Now, the president offered last month to provide India with commercial nuclear technology. That new policy would abandon a long-standing U.S. policy of not helping India so long as it remains outside the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the system for monitoring nuclear facilities and preventing the spread of weapons technology worldwide. Now, how do you say that India can have nuclear weapons, but Iran and North Korea cannot have nuclear weapons? Asks Sidney Drell. Drell is a longtime government nuclear policy advisor and a professor and deputy director emeritus at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center. And Drell said, "I'm more than a little uncomfortable with our India policy. We are at a danger point," he said, "as to maintaining a hold on the non-proliferation regime." Now, William Potter. Potter leads the non-proliferation program at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. And Potter said that Bush is sending a mixed signal that might push some countries to consider going nuclear. The Bush administration is really saying that some proliferation is bad, but some nuclear proliferation is good. Now, the president is working at odds with his own policy, in Potter's view. "The current threat goes well beyond North Korea and Iran," said Allison, the former Clinton administration official. He said that there could be a cascade of proliferation if North Korea and Iran both go nuclear, said Allison. Now, Allison has written extensively on nuclear terrorism. And he went on to say that people take a false comfort from the Cold War experience. The strategic logic now is this: nuclear weapons are the equalizer for the weak, not the strong. These factors generally make the new arms race slowly taking shape more troubling than the Cold War version. First, only a tiny number of industrialized countries had the technological means to build warheads during the Cold War. However, today, eight nations now possess nuclear weapons, with North Korea probably the ninth. But there are now dozens of countries that have developed the basic capability to enrich uranium or reprocess plutonium, which is the key to producing these nuclear warheads. Perhaps 40 countries now have such technical knowledge. Now, Mohammed El-Baradi, he's the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, said in an interview just last year, he said few are in fact enriching uranium, but El-Baradi said that these efforts amount to latent weapons programs. Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and South Africa fall into this category. All of these countries are fully capable of producing enriched uranium and then nuclear weapons. And second, with the dissemination of nuclear know-how to countries from Pakistan to Sweden to Brazil, shadowy nuclear technology rings have taken shape, making once forbidden equipment and expertise far more widely available to terrorists and terrorist groups, as well as to other nations and nation states. Concerns over such networks have grown sharply since Pakistan disclosed that the father of the Pakistan nuclear weapons program, his name was Abdul Qadir Khan, had for many years been illegally selling these nuclear enrichment technologies and even bomb plans to the North Koreans and the Libyans, and it is believed that he also sold or delivered these plans to Iran. Now, Khan relied on a network that he wove, and it wove its way through Qatar, Malaysia, and many other countries. And the third and perhaps most troubling aspect of this new arms race is the presence of terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda that are not bound by the discipline of self-preservation, which helped restrain the Soviets and the United States, as well as China during the Cold War. Now remember, China has its own small nuclear arsenal. And that small nuclear arsenal, well, small compared to the United States and the Soviet Union, is still enough to destroy the entire United States military and economic machine. Now, groups that produce suicide bombers by the dozens are believed eager not just to obtain nuclear weapons, but to use those nuclear weapons no matter what the cost. They don't follow the logic of deterrence. So Cold War tactics do no longer apply in the 21st century. These groups rarely even have an easily identified headquarters to retaliate against. Now, such groups would focus not on precision or maximum yield, just detonating a nuclear device in a populated area, like Washington, D.C., or Manhattan, or Los Angeles, or San Francisco, would do the job. Imagine sailing a fishing boat into San Francisco Harbor and tying up at Fisherman's Wharf, and then detonating a nuclear device on the waterfront in San Francisco, California, or putting a nuclear device into a container, a shipping container, just a box, 8 feet wide, 40 feet long, 20 feet long, and loading it on a container ship, which just sails into San Francisco Harbor, Los Angeles, Long Beach, New York. You know, people are smuggled into the United States in these containers every day from China and Korea, the Philippines, countries all over the world ship containers to the United States. Surely, if human beings can be put into a container in the Philippines and shipped to San Francisco, a nuclear weapon can be put into that same container with a suicide bomber, can it not? Now, theirs is not unlike the thinking behind the Hiroshima bombing, which, as Agnew recalled, was fraught with uncertainties. Now, Agnew, remember, is the former head of the Los Alamos Laboratory, and he was a nuclear physicist riding in the chase plane alongside the Enola Gay. Agnew, who is retired and now living near San Diego, said that while preparing for the Hiroshima blast, he had been terrified that he might not survive it, that he might be on a suicide mission. No one knew how these bombers would be affected after they dropped the bomb, and he recorded only one thought. He recalled in his flight log, wow, it really went off. He said he wrote without acknowledgement of the broader meaning of the moment. It really worked. After the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, very few experts expected any new arms race. There was widespread talk of weapons reductions, even disarmament, as one of the peace dividends that Americans would enjoy. It now seems distant, but in 1995, an anti-nuclear organization called the Pugwash Conference, on Science and World Affairs, won the Nobel Peace Prize in recognition of the new tenor of the times. Now, the superpowers have made some strides in reducing their arsenals. The United States, with its peak, fielded more than 32,000 nuclear warheads. The United States is now about 10,000, or about one-third, of its peak nuclear arsenal. Russia today has about 7,200. The two countries combined have deactivated 6,632 warheads and destroyed 582 intercontinental ballistic missiles, according to the Russian-American Nuclear Security Advisory Council. Under the Moscow Treaty, each side has committed to reducing its arsenal to 2,200 or fewer deployed warheads by the year 2012. Now, that indeed is a step in the right direction. The desire to prevent nuclear proliferation traces back to the months immediately following the horrifying bombings at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But by that time, the genie was out of the jar. President Harry Truman always said that he had no regrets about dropping the two atomic bombs on Japan to end World War II, but he did worry about the spread of the weapons. The hope of civilization lies in international arrangements looking, if possible, to the renunciation of the use and development of the atomic bomb. Truman wrote that in a letter to Congress on October the 3rd, 1945. The next U.S. president, Dwight Eisenhower, proposed in his famous Atoms for Peace speech at the United Nations on December the 8th, 1953, that the United States and the Soviet Union should scrap their warheads. And he suggested that they hand over the secrets of the atomic bomb to the United Nations body that would share them for civilian purposes and to produce an age of prosperity. But neither side gave up its warheads, and the arms race roared on. Eisenhower's proposed fostered system that provided the training and civilian nuclear equipment to scientists around the world unintentionally set the stage for the proliferation of nuclear technology worldwide. Superpower rivalries no longer drive the arms race, making the Cold War model today irrelevant. Regional tensions that long predate that ideological conflict and far exceed its emotional content are the new challenge today. In their standoff, India and Pakistan have both developed and tested nuclear weapons. Israel has built what is believed to be a large clandestine arsenal to fend off its neighbors, including Syria, Egypt, and Iran. If Iran succeeds in building nuclear warheads, it is expected to increase the pressure on Turkey, Syria, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt to push forward with their own programs to develop nuclear weapons. And similar friction has Eastern Asia on edge as it watches American negotiators trying to force North Korea to abandon its weapons and extensive nuclear facilities. Donald Gregg, he's the president of the Korea Society in New York and a former senior CIA officer in Asia. He was an ambassador to South Korea, said that if the United States fails, then Japan, South Korea, and even Taiwan could consider building nuclear arsenals. They already have advanced nuclear capabilities. Now, there's a sort of nuclear domino theory afoot today, said Gregg, who traveled three times recently to North Korea. If we can stop North Korea, I think we can stop the region from going nuclear. But if not, This is our last best shot. Well, we're about out of time. Let me make a comment or two. You know, from a youngster born before the nuclear age, most of you listeners out there have lived with the bomb all of your lives. But as a small child, I can remember World War II and the news reports that came in. We thought when the nuclear bomb was dropped that the end of the world had come. And my Aunt Bessie said that with this nuclear bomb, surely Armageddon is at the door. The religious people thought this is it. Little could we have imagined back in 1945 in our innocence, the world as it is today, 60 years later. A world in which the United States has 10,000 nuclear warheads and the Soviet Union 7,000, enough nuclear warheads to annihilate all life from off the planet. And Jesus of Nazareth made an observation in Matthew 24. He said that if he does not intervene in world events to prevent that very eventuality, he said all life from off the planet or on the planet would be destroyed on this planet. That's Matthew chapter 24. You can read that also in Mark 13 and Luke 21. Now that's quite a statement. Bible prophecy 2,000 years ago said that in this age, at the end of the age, in a period of time when it would be possible to annihilate all life from off the planet. You heard it first. That thought, that concept is biblical in nature. That wasn't developed after 1945. It was developed 2,000 years prior to 1945. In fact, it was developed first by Ezekiel in Ezekiel chapter 6. Ezekiel chapter 6. We'll cover that a little later, maybe in the next program when we talk about this thing of nuclear proliferation, living with the bomb. Well, we're about out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. Let me give you a reminder as we leave the air that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. Remember, for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, simply call the Law School at 417-273-4967 to order that free 4-hour introductory CD package. That number again, area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal. Says time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.